Welcome to Developer Diaries with Ben Wilson, in association with the All About Property Facebook group.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Developer Diaries. This is episode 6, and it will unfortunately be the final episode, at least for now, that we're going to record. It's very time consuming doing these podcasts, and as much as it is enjoyable, we've also got huge amounts of work on at the moment, and for that reason I've decided to make this the last one. I probably will do some in the future, more sporadically, about certain projects that we're doing. But for now, this is going to be the last one. So I hope you enjoy it. This one's going to be really all about the tricks of the trade of development. We've talked a lot already about design, leases and leases freehold, all the various aspects of that. We've also talked in detail about a number of other things. We've had guests on. But I felt for the final podcast, it would make sense to talk about the things I've learned along the way in the last 18, 19 years working in property. So that's the plan. I'm joined today by Jacob Pitsialis, who has worked for me at the Knight James Group for 8 months now. I've known Jacob in a personal capacity for probably 7 or 8 years, maybe. His uncle and auntie own a very beautiful Greek restaurant called Siakos. Give them a name check. Get discount next time I go. I should already, to be honest. They serve some of the best Greek food in London, if anyone wants to go. So Jacob used to work there, used to chat to him when I was there, and when he found out that I had a vacancy at the company, he approached me, caught me a bit off guard. I didn't expect him to ask. And I thought, this guy must have something about him, because, you know, he's come to me and asked for a job, and I thought that was, you know, that was impressive. So here he is. So Jacob, welcome.
Thank you, Ben.
So Jacob is going to be asking some questions and interviewing me along the way, and it's nice to have him on the podcast. We had Liam, who used to work for me, on the podcast on the first episode, and on the final one we'll have Jacob. Unfortunately, Marianne, that works for me, she is away on holiday living up in Portugal, so she is not going to be here. So the first thing that we always do is we have a market update about the property market. A lot has happened in the last few months. Things have transitioned from a very much a seller's market 6 months ago to a buyer's market, which if you go back through the podcast, I talked about that, felt that was happening. We've obviously seen interest rates rise to now at 5%. They're predicted to go up another 0.25% probably next week. Obviously, this has had an impact on a lot of things in the property market, and prices have dropped. Prices generally are very specific to the area that people are buying in, and it's very difficult when you read the Halifax price index that prices have dropped 3.8% or whatever they're saying they've dropped. That's obviously an average. In some areas they've probably dropped 10 or 15%, in other areas they've gone up. So it you really need to know the market you're operating in to say how much prices have dropped or gone up by. So where we're operating in central London, places like Maida Vale, which have a lot more of a local market, they have probably, I'm seeing like 3 to 5% drops. In the prime areas, they've been less affected. The super prime market, sort of 5-10 million plus, is still very, very busy, presumably because the pound is so weak and people are buying in US dollars in many cases, which, again, I've talked about at length before. I see things probably softening for the next 6 months or so. Inflation does seem to be coming down now as a result of these interest rate rises, which is fantastic. And the government have now, or the FCA have now, stepped in to make sure that banks will be more heavily regulated with regards to the interest that they're passing on to their savers, because the reason that the government are increasing interest rates is to encourage people to save. Obviously, if the banks are not giving them better rates as a result of that, then that's not helping the situation, which is why the FCA have no doubt stepped in. So I think you'll find that inflation hopefully will have dropped again significantly this month, and that will hopefully mean that we're coming to the peak of interest rates. I've actually got to remortgage my own flat in September, which I'm not looking forward to. It's going to go up significantly, and the rates I'm looking at are like 5.95%, so it's a huge increase. I used to pay like 7 or 8% on my bridging finance, so we're not far off the lows of bridging finance, which is bonkers really. I think, you know, the key at the moment is that you've got to make sure that your product is better than it's ever been. You need to make sure that you are doing stuff to a really fantastic standard so that it will still sell even in a tougher market, which I'll come on to more in a minute. The one thing I have noticed though as well is that the buyers who are, a lot of buyers don't want to do refurb projects now. If you can imagine, people have got less money to spend each month because their interest payments are increasing. So they, you can't leverage your refurbishment costs. You have to pay for that in cash. So if all your cash is being eaten by mortgage interest, then you're not going to have as much to refurbish the flat that you buy. So we're seeing a lot of people that want to buy refurbished properties, which for us as developers is great. So yeah, that's the end of the market update, the final market update. We're now going to move on to the tricks of the trade, property development, things I've learned in my career. I didn't really want it to all be about, you know, oh, I do this, so therefore I'm amazing and that's great, you should do it. I wanted it more to be a bit more technical and a little bit more about specific things that we do as a company to make money and capitalize on property that we buy. A couple of things though generally that I think are important, and if I racked my brain to think of three things that I feel as an entrepreneur and a businessman have really helped me and hopefully tried to put me ahead of the curve at times anyway. And the three things that I came up with was one, the so-called 5 a.m. club, getting up really early and starting work early. I think that's absolutely crucial if you're running a business. The whole thing of you can get up at 9, you got to finish at 4, that to me that just doesn't cut it. I'm up at 5 every day and I'm in the office for 7 most days and I'm doing my paperwork and I've done 2 hours of work by the time most people have got to work, which frees up my day then to do site meetings and so on. So I think if you want to get into this business, you have to work your ass off. You have to work 60, 70, 80 hour weeks. If you want to do 40 hour weeks, it's probably not the business for you. Not if you want to grow a big business anyway. The second thing is your network is so important. So if you are looking to grow a property business from a smaller business into a multi-million pound developer, you really have to have a fantastic network of people around you. So what I mean by that, it doesn't necessarily have to be all wealthy people around you, but you need to have good people that you can rely on and who believe in you and who will pass your name on to people and help you to grow your business. And when you need to lean on someone to help you with something, you're able to call up the CEO of a business because you've nurtured that relationship for 5 or 10 years with them, and you can get information from the CEO of, let's say, a recruitment company that you could never get from someone who's a junior recruiter. So having that network is absolutely key. And I've talked about that in the past. And the third thing, so we've got the hard work and dedication, having an amazing network of people in your business. And then the other thing is just to be a sponge and to learn as much as you can about the property business. And, you know, I've always been very inquisitive, probably too much so at times, always asking questions, always wanting to know why the answer is no, why can't we change this, what does this mean? And I think if you do those three things, more than, even if you didn't listen to anything I'm about to tell you on all of the other things in this podcast, if you work your ass off, you network like hell, and you learn your subject and you become an expert in it, 10,000 hour rule and all of that, but really let's call it 50,000, 100,000 hour rule, then you will be very successful in what you do, almost without question. And if you don't, then I don't know, maybe you're an asshole. But in all seriousness, if you do those three things, you'll have a lot of success. So that's sort of the generalized stuff finished. As I say, I want to be more specific rather than just talking about those sorts of things. So Jacob, over to you, I guess. Where should we start?
What things do you look for when you're trying to find a project?
So there's a number of things we look for. I mean, for one thing we've had a lot of problems with lately has been we've always been a leasehold buyer of property, and we've had a lot of problems with license to alters lately. Things have been taking 3 to 6 months sometimes to get consent, often to do fairly minor works, which is ridiculous. So one thing I've tried to do more recently is start to look at buying freehold property. In central London, that's difficult to do because they're very expensive. And we couldn't previously afford to buy freeholds a lot of the time. We had to buy leaseholds. Now we've got a little bit more money behind us, we're able to buy freehold buildings and look at that. So that's something I think if you can get a freehold, fantastic. If it's a share of freehold, often you don't have much more control than if you have just a leasehold property. So a lot of people have a misconception about share of freehold flats being very similar to owning the freehold of a building. It's not at all, because you get one or two difficult neighbours and they can make your life an absolute nightmare. I've had an experience with that recently. I won't name which property. There's been a few, to be fair. So I think, yeah, if you can buy a freehold, fantastic. If you can't, then a leasehold's fine. Don't be afraid of buying short leases. Short leases are great because a lot of people won't buy them. They're scared of them. I would think, as a plucking a number out of the sky, maybe 25% of the marketplace will look at a very short lease property. Most end users won't, even if they're cash buyers, because they don't understand them. They don't understand the process to extend them. So again, if you can educate yourself, you can capitalize on the fact that the lease is short. Normally what you pay for the lease, you make profit on top of that. And I've talked about it with Rebecca. It's kind of like doing a kitchen refurbishment. You're paying for your kitchen, but you're making money on top of it because you're making the property more marketable. And so don't be afraid of looking at short leases is something I would advise. I think just make sure you understand them before you buy one, and you have good legal team around you to make sure you don't get caught out. I think one thing I always look for as well is I look for, when I'm looking through Rightmove, I look for flats that have an odd number of bedrooms for the price. So it might be that a studio flat looks really expensive, but often that studio flat could be turned into like a three-bedroom flat or a two-bedroom flat. And some, I mean, you don't see loads of them, but you do see times when someone's just decided to take all the walls out. You've got this huge space that you could put mezzanines in and create something really cool out of. So I'm looking for things that are unusual for the bedroom ratio to price. So on the flip side of that, you might have a four-bedroom flat that's priced like a one or a two-bedroom flat. So anything that you can see that looks a bit off the normal sort of track, that for me is a buy signal, and to look into. I think also when you're searching for property, you've got to make sure that you do you give your properties back to the estate agents that you're buying them from, because invariably that's forming a relationship and it's making it easier to keep buying more and more properties from them. And something else we talked about previously was angles. More angles equals more profit, and again, I'll reiterate that. If you're extending the flat, plus you're doing a lease extension, plus you're refurbishing it more generally, you're going to make generally a lot more money than if you're just buying something to do a lease extension on. The more angles that you've got, a distress seller might be another one, the more money you're going to make. So look for things where you can add significant value in multiple places. That is what I would advise. And finally, I would say, when you're searching for property, the numbers don't lie. I mentioned this before, don't try and fit a square peg into a round hole, so to speak. Just make sure that you follow the numbers. If it says you're going to make 15% on cost, you're probably going to make less in reality. So don't try and squeeze it and change things so it looks like 20%. And when you end up doing it, you've made 10% and you're 10% down from where you should be. I mentioned that in another podcast we did. That's really important. Yeah.
In terms of the buying process, what things do you look to make the process straightforward and maximize return?
So in terms of purchasing, I will recap on certain things I've done here previously, but you've got to have a good legal team around you. A lot of people skimp on a lawyer. They'll pay like £800 for a conveyancing firm in Swansea. No offence to people that are from Swansea. And they'll have like 50 conveyancers sat in a room who all share the files, and generally they're just not very good. You're much better off to pay £2,000-£2,500 and have a great London-based lawyer or a city-based lawyer, not always in the city, but often you tend to find a lot of the best lawyers tend to be in the cities because they're getting paid more, and you know, it's just there's more people in the cities, so you have, you know, it's more competition, so the best lawyers tend to be there, from my experience anyway. So get a really good lawyer and it will be worth their weight in gold. I think another thing we look at, I've mentioned this previously, I'm sure, the hybrid model we follow is buying something as a cash buyer and then refinancing it between exchange and completion. So we're at the top of the pile in terms of buyers because we're cash buyers, and then we're refinancing so that we can leverage the property and therefore maximize our return on capital, which I've talked about in the finance podcast of this run of shows. So go back to that. It was episode 5. And you can have a look at that. Obviously, not everybody when they start out is going to have cash to just buy something for £250,000 or £1 million. But as you get bigger as a developer and you start to make more money, then, or you're using investors' money to grow the business, then this is a model that you really should follow, I think, because it just makes your returns better, but it also puts you at the top of the pile for buying things. So I think that's important. One thing we've also learned to do is if we're doing a project that has a that has extension work or planning permission that needs to be done, we do pre-applications on them, which they take 4 weeks. They cost about £800 plus your architect's fees of maybe £1,000, £2,000, if, depending on how involved it is. So for a few thousand pounds, you can get a very, very good indication of what you can and can't get planning for. And the downside of that is, of course, you could lose those fees if the deal falls through. But in reality, your interest costs are going to be high as soon as you complete. And if you've waited a month, 2 months to start the work, then you're going to pay thousands in interest anyway. So I would say only one in five of our deals falls through, touch wood. So I would advise people to get going with the pre-app. If there is going to be an extension or changes to the exterior, or it's listed, you can do a pre-app on the listed front, on the LBC, listed building consent. Then I would suggest that people get on with that and do that, and that they will save themselves money on interest costs. Another thing, my development lenders won't be happy about me saying this, but brokers are great. They're worth their weight in gold in many ways. But if you know of a good development lender, then you can go direct to them and you can save yourself 0.5% probably on the way in, which on £1 million loan, you know, it's 5K. It's quite a lot of money. Another little name drop, Octane. I use Octane Capital for a lot of my finance, who are very, very good lenders, and I would highly recommend them. If you quote Ben Wilson at checkout, you'll save your brokerage fee, and maybe I'll get a drink from them. No, I'm joking. I won't get a drink. So go to them direct. You'll save some money. And then the other thing is with the lenders, when you've got a lender, they'll often get like two quotes for solicitor's fees, and they'll often be quite high sometimes. And I'll regularly push back on solicitor's costs. So you can get them down. There's no reason why you can't say, they want your business at the end of the day as the client. So there's no reason why you can't say, look, thank you, but I don't want to pay 4,000 plus VAT for your solicitors. And they'll go away and they'll come back and they'll bring the cost down. I've regularly got things down by £1,000 a deal. If you're doing 4 or 5 deals a year, like we are now, it's £5,000 a year you save on solicitors fees. It all adds up, all hits your bottom line and improves it. So, and the same with quantity surveyors fees. Some development lenders use quantity surveyors, some use asset managers, which are cheaper. But QS fees can be easily £1,000 a visit. And if you push back on those, there's no reason why you can't save quite a lot of money as well.
Once you've purchased something, what do you tend to do to add value to it?
Well, this is a big, big question. Going to give all my secrets away here. So well, you're lucky. You see them every day. But for the guys and girls that are listening, things that I look for in particular. So the first thing is, I think when you're looking at a flat or a house, you want to look at find all the negatives with that property. Almost every property is going to have negatives. Even something at 10 million is going to have things that for a £10 million buyer are not perfectly how they would want them to be. And in reality, the difference between selling something for absolutely top money and selling something for rubbish money, other than obviously the finish, is that the one at the top money has as few compromises as possible. Compromises equals a loss of value to buyers. So what you're looking to do when you're buying a development is look at it and go, well, hang on a minute, that's not great, and that's not great, and that's not great. So I'm going to minimize the impact of those three things that I don't like or buyers won't like. And at the same time, on the flip side, you're also looking to maximize the amazing thing. So if it's got a huge roof terrace, you're going to design the terrace so it's a sexy terrace and looks incredible. But equally, if it's a walk up and it's four flights of stairs up, you want to look to minimize the walk up with people. So some examples that I came up with, we did a project recently on Sutherland Avenue in Maida Vale, and it had no private outside space. It had a half acre communal garden, which it had amazing views out over it in the tennis court, but it had no private space. So what we did is we replaced the window that was there, the old window, and we put in a bifold window that looks exactly the same from the outside. And we replaced it with a bifolding window and created a winter garden, which enabled you to walk through from the living room out to the down the steps to the communal garden. But then you could pull this entire window away 2.5 meters width, and because it was a tiled floor as well, it felt like a balcony. So you had, in the summer, you could sit there with a glass of wine with the window open, and it felt like a balcony space. And that, for me, overcame objections from buyers saying, well, I only want a flat that's got private outside space, because I think if I was that buyer and someone showed me that window that pulled back, I'd be like, do you know what? It wasn't what I was expecting, but I'm still going to buy the flat because it's amazing, other than this thing. And I think that was one of the reasons that we got 1.3 million for that flat, which was a big pound per square foot. Part of the reason was because of that cool room. We put a bar in there, and it was a very cool flat, very 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 different, very quirky, but we made it work. Another example of this would be, we've got a project in Knightsbridge where we own the four floors of the building, and we've got a fourth and fifth floor walk up, and people in rich areas do not like walk-ups. They are unpopular. And I was very nervous when I bought the two flats that this would be a problem flat. So the way to get around that is to get as much outside space up there as possible. So we're putting in an application to add another roof terrace, which I'm hoping we'll get. And then I'm also negotiating with the neighbours to be able to buy part of the hallway so that you enter the flat on the third floor rather than the fourth floor. So if you can imagine, when you're viewing the property now, the estate agent will take you up, and a good estate agent will stop on the third floor, let you catch your breath a little bit, show you, explain the building and talk about the lobby that's there and the storage or whatever, and then you'll carry on upstairs. That is much better on a viewing than someone going up four flights in one go and being absolutely knackered and out of breath when they get upstairs. And a good estate agent will know that, and will make sure that the buyer is shown around everything, and it slows them down. And having that floor one floor lower, it makes quite a big difference. And it's and that's why we've been prepared to pay the other flat, I won't say how much, but because we're still in negotiations, but pay them a figure for that hallway, because it benefits us, and then they get the benefit of some money. And one other example was, again, at Sutherland Avenue, we had a mezzanine kitchen which had a bedroom two underneath it, and I knew that there was going to be objections about an internal bedroom, so I put in an electric blind to make it more private. I put in sound rated acoustic glass in the windows. I put a whole acoustic shell around the bedroom so that when you're in the kitchen you wouldn't hear it in the bedroom. So when buyers, again, are on viewings, we're saying, or the agent's saying to them, if they're a good agent, this is a soundproof box, this is acoustic glass, electric blinds, and really trying to overcome that objection before it becomes a really big objection. And really, we're trying to preempt objection from buyers and design around that. That is what a good developer should do. And every single project we do, I know, because I've been in this so long now, I know exactly what are going to be the objections. It may be that the window's on the wrong side, the flat faces the wrong way. How do you get around that? And often there are very clever ways that you're able to get around that. And a lot of developers miss it. A lot of developers, they don't go into the level of detail that I think we try to do. And some developers I see, and there's, you can see they put loads of thought into it and they're amazing. Others, I go around and I just think, Christ, like, this is just... you've missed a trick. Like, why have you not done that? Which is, I guess, good for us if we hopefully have done it on our project, that hopefully it will sell above theirs. Another thing I always look at is, when I'm buying something, is I try to look at volume. So rather than just seeing a flat on like a flat plane where you just have room after room after room, I like to look at the overall volume of the space, because often you're able to add square footage, especially in London where square footage is key because it's so valuable. You're able to add mezzanines in and add extra space in just by being clever with the volume that's there. So about 10 years ago, I used to work at Marsh & Parsons Estate Agents, and the freeholder above us on Baker Street, he refurbished the building, and he dropped the ceilings in Marsh & Parsons before we took the lease on by like a meter on the ground floor. And then because of that, he managed to squeeze in an entire new floor between the first and second floors because the ceilings were so high. So he added a flat worth probably 4 million into the building, on top of getting permission for a mansard. And the guy used to pull up, I can't remember his name, but he used to pull up in a Range Rover, in a Rolls Royce Phantom, a white Phantom, every day and inspect the works. And I just remember like thinking what an incredible developer he was. And it's always stuck in my head that volume is so important, because you can exploit it. Don't just look at flats as flat a flat one level space, look at them and see where you can manage to get extra square footage out of things. And another good example of that is in the old London butterfly roofs, where they where you have a roof like that, you can often chisel out the lofts above and get like a study, like a mezzanine study. So we've done that in the past, and it's a great way to add value. And also just getting ceiling heights up everywhere. You know, we push whenever we buy something, the first thing I want to do is to make it as big as I possibly can. Obviously, you can't knock through into neighbours' houses. Short of that, you can, you know, we push everything up. A lot of flats in the 70s and 80s were pushed together to try and, often for fire reasons, to give a fire breaks between the flats. So obviously, you've got to make sure you put them back in some other way. And they also did it to conserve heat, because people didn't want to spend fortunes in the 70s when there was a lot of problems and strikes heating rooms. So we will exploit that, and we will push rooms right back up to the full height. I think we did a project in Notting Hill about 3 years ago on Clanricarde Gardens, and the ceilings had been lowered by 800 millimetres. Wow. So we went from, I think, 2.6 metres to 3.4 metres, which was, I reckon, it cost us £1,000 to take the ceiling down, and I reckon it added at least 100,000 to the value of that £1 million flat. It would have been no way more than 900 grand if we hadn't had these incredible ceilings. So, you know, it's £1,000 spent, 100 grand added. So it's a nice way to make money if you can do it. Another thing to talk about is making sure you hit your target market with layouts and the balance of a flat. So as an example, we've got a flat at the moment we're doing in Bayswater, which the angle on that flat, we bought it it was a very overly large buy-to-let property. It had no outside space. People generally don't like great big flats at the top of buildings if there's no outside space, because families don't want them. Penthouse buyers don't want them because they want outside space. So the angle on that for us was to get outside space. So we agreed to make a load of changes to the building, reinstating the original sash windows on the front and the back. And in return, the council gave us a 7 metre by 1.2 metre balcony, which we've now built. And I think the same flat without the balcony would be worth probably 500,000 less than the balcony, than with the balcony, because the market just isn't there for these huge flats with an outside space. You know, people would just rather buy something on the ground floor of the garden or you know, a smaller flat that has outside space on a lower floor. So it can make huge difference to the value. And, but you know, the key in this is to know that that was the issue. And I knew that was the problem. The reason we paid about £850 a square foot for the flat. You know, and the reason it was so cheap was because it was in poor condition, and it was just a massive flat with no outside space, and no one really wanted it, and no one saw the potential in it. So that's important. I mean, it goes without saying as well, looking to when you're, you know, refurbishing things, and I'm talking about adding value, but also you need to try and look for cost savings wherever you can as well, because, you know, prices are rising on everything at the moment. All of our costs go up and up and up and up. And I think, you know, you've got to look to make savings. Any little wins you can have along the way in a development is really important, because you're going to get a lot more losses where you're losing money in terms of prices going up. So that's what I would talk about as well. I've got a few extra ones here. I mean, I think more beds equals more profit is generally true. I think there's... it's different if you're developing outside of London. I think generally outside of London, in areas that are cheaper areas, generally having more bedrooms, you will get a higher price for the property, because people, you don't tend to value things on square foot in I don't know, let's say you're in Macclesfield. You don't tend to value, or you definitely wouldn't value on pound square foot normally, maybe unless you were doing valuing a portfolio or something, but you generally wouldn't. And so people are looking at the number of bedrooms and the capital value of something. By that I mean sort of three bed is worth X or two bed is worth Y. So generally more bedrooms equals more profit, but often in London and in cities where prices are higher, often a good two bed will be much more valuable than a compromised three bed. You know, and we've made good money in the past by doing projects like that, as I've spoken about before. I think again with the bedrooms, you need to make sure you've got the right bathroom ratio as well. So if you're doing a five-bedroom house, it's gonna, your buyer might have three kids. You don't really want two bathrooms, you know, because the parents are going to want their own ensuite. Yeah. So then you've got three kids sharing one bathroom plus guests. This doesn't work. You need to have three bathrooms. So not having that bathroom might cost you 50 or 100 grand if it's a £2 million house. You know, so you've really got to think about that. One thing that I always talk about a lot and drive the builders mad with is the wall thicknesses. So often, like, he's laughing because I am so religious on it and I get really pissy about tiny millimeters of space being lost, because that some of the flats we're working on are so valuable per square foot, like 3,000 quid a square foot in Knightsbridge, for example. We, like, even like 10 meters of wall, so 30 foot of wall roughly, if it was 2 centimeters sticking out further in a £3,000 a metre flat, it would be like 6.5K of lost value just from that 20 mil board. And I really, like, hammer home to my builders about this. So I think whenever you're operating, again, in the more expensive parts of town or in London, like, really have a think about, instead of just, builders often like to just put plasterboard on top of existing bonding. You're much better off, if it's not going to cost you a fortune to do, hack that bonding, get a labourer there for a day on 100 quid a day, hack that wall off, then put your plasterboard on, save 20 or 30 mil down the entire party wall on both sides, and you're going to make thousands of pounds more. And it is the easiest thing to do. It just requires someone for a couple of days to knock the render off or whatever. And I think, yeah, one other thing that we look to do is to try and capitalize on awkward spaces. So often in flats you get areas which are just awkward corners that can't be used. I always try and create something out of them which, you know, makes them a bit more interesting. So maybe we'll put in a bar, or we put in a wine fridge once on a staircase going up to a huge roof terrace, because I just had visions of people wanting to walk up there, take a bottle of wine out, sit on the terrace, get drunk with their friends. Often if we get a kitchen which has got a corner cabinet which we can't use and it backs onto a hallway, then maybe we'll put in a washing machine access from the hallway. We did that in a flat we did in St Mark's Road in W10, and it was a great use of space because we couldn't use that corner cupboard. You would have had this weird, you know, the little swingy round ones you put your pots in that are just annoying. So we got rid of that. Put that in. And one thing we also try and buy ancillary space around flats. So we're doing a number of deals at the moment where we bought hallways, we're buying various bits and bobs. Sometimes we don't even need to buy them. If we're the freeholder, we're able to add them on. And if the value is high of the property, you can add a lot of value, hundreds of thousands, by doing that. Obviously, if you're doing it in an area where it's a £50,000 house, then I wouldn't suggest you start offering people £5,000 to buy little tiny hallways and adding them on, because you won't make the money back. But I guess more for the people that are listening to this and are based in central London, then adding on a cupboard that's 30 square foot in somewhere like Knightsbridge, you know, it's £100,000 of value added almost. So I think that speaks for itself.
Have you got any tips and tricks for negotiating with neighbours and freeholders when
For these sorts of spaces? Yeah, I mean, there's different schools of thought on negotiating with people. And I'm not saying my way is the right way, but it's my way has always worked for me generally. I generally try to be fair in my negotiations. So when you're going into a situation with a neighbour who's never met you, as far as they're concerned, they're going to have a preconceived idea that you're a bastard developer, you're not going to be very nice, you're going to be slimy, like, you know, all the things that you get. There's a lot of preconceptions about developers, and they're greedy, blah, blah, blah. So really what I want to do is change that opinion immediately when people meet me. I don't think none of those things, but I want people to realize very quickly that I'm not greedy and I'm not slimy and I am going to be fair. So my way of negotiating is to offer fairly from day one. So say it's a hallway that I'm prepared to pay £50,000 for maximum. I'll probably offer 30, 35,000 for it initially, to leave a little bit in the tank to see where we are. Rather than come in like a lot of developers do at £5,000 or £10,000, mm-hmm. chancing their arm, maybe one in five places they get it at a cheap price, because people don't negotiate very well.
Yep.
But equally, I think a lot of people probably just look at them and just think, well, you're an asshole. You know it's worth more than 5,000. So why have you come in and you're taking the piss, basically? Excuse my swearing. I swear like a navvy. And so I would advise people to go in with fair offers. And you know, I work out things based on a spreadsheet of what I can pay. And at the end of the day, if I buy that hallway for 50 grand, I've still worked it out that I'm going to make X amount of money, even if I pay that. If I get it for 40 and I've made 10 grand more, great. You know, it's a bit of a cushion in case anything else goes wrong in the deal. But I would advise to offer fairly. It changes people's opinion of you straight away. But I do tell them that I do that as well. So I'll say, look, this is my offer. It's 35 grand. The way I negotiate is that, you know, I'm not offering you this because I'm going to offer you double this. That's not how I try to offer you a fair offer at the beginning. So, and then you set the scene with people that, you know, you're not going to just suddenly increase it three times.
Yeah.
And for me, it's always been a successful way. It's very rare that we don't come to an agreement with someone. In fact, touch wood, it hasn't happened, I don't think. But I'm sure it will at some point. But sometimes people are just totally unreasonable. You can't negotiate with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's their prerogative.
I know as a company, we use mezzanines to add square footage. How has that worked in the past?
We've added quite a lot of square foot using mezzanines. They're only generally good to do if an area, it can be full height. What you don't want to do is add a mezzanine with like 1.5 meter ceilings, because it's just, it becomes, what do? You put beanbags there and sit and read a book, or it becomes like a play area for some kids because they can stand up because it's low. If you want to maximize the value, you want to have a full height mezzanine. So to do that, generally you need 4 meters. And 4 meters allows you about 100 millimeters of floor build-up in between, which is very hard to build a large floor build-up that thin, but we have managed to do it before. Anything less than 4 meters, very difficult to get a full-height mezzanine on both sides of it. We did a project on Linden Gardens about 5 years ago, and I added in a mezzanine there, and we added in a second double bedroom and added an ensuite, and that added, I would have thought, probably about 250k, the value. But we had to do this incredible hanging steel structure, which was expensive and probably cost us 30 or 40 grand to do. But it was still, you know, worth doing. And as I said before, look for butterfly roofs where you can add things under the loft space. Mezzanines are always a great idea, but again, only do it if you're in an area where you can justify the expenditure on it, and also where you're going to get the money back. You wouldn't just want to add a mezzanine everywhere, because a lot of the time it wouldn't add any value. Just a couple of other things. So one thing that's important is you've got to get your planning permission design correct. So for example, we got a project in Bayswater. We really wanted a south-facing skylight. It's a north-facing living space. And the council wouldn't let me have a south-facing skylight. And I had to push and push and push and push. Basically, say I wouldn't build it unless we got it. And eventually, they agreed that we could have it, because our kitchen would have been horrible and dark. So you need to think about things like that. You need to make sure you've got as much natural light in properties, and that if something's lacking, this comes down to what I said before about, you know, issues. You need to preempt them and minimise them. Then you need to make sure that you get the right planning permission that's going to maximise the value. So you need a good architect and someone who's going to obviously tell you the ways that you can maximize those things. And just one final thing that we do when it comes to looking for ways to exploit value and create value, there's a number of rules when it comes to planning, for example, like the four-year rule with, for example, if you use your roof terrace for 4 years and it's not a listed building, then after 4 years, it will become a usable space in the eyes of you can get a certificate of lawfulness for it in the eyes of the planners. It doesn't necessarily mean that you own it. If it's a leasehold property, you would have to get it demised by the freeholder. So a lot of people make that mistake. They think, great, I've got a roof terrace. And then when you come to sell it, they find out that actually it's not theirs. It belongs to the freeholder. And then he wants, because he knows you're selling, he wants 20 grand for you to put it on your lease, which you would probably do because you're desperate to get your buyer to pay more for it because it's got a terrace. So we look to exploit these things, and as developers. So if I see a door on a flat onto a flat roof, like it's like my ears prick up. Sorry. Yeah. And my eyes, because it's if there's a door there and it's been there more than 4 years and it's not listed, the council can't make you get rid of it. That door is staying. So you can then go to the council and say, well, I want to put a safety barrier around that terrace because it's dangerous, because my kids could walk out that door and fall off the roof. The council very rarely will stop you doing it because it's there. They know that you have got access to that now. So we've had a number of flats where we've had these doors sat there. We've then got permission to put railings up. and then you've got a £200,000 roof terrace ad. You know, so look for these sorts of things when you're buying things. Look for ways to create value and be smart about it, and look for ways to add outside space, especially in cities where it's at a premium. Yep. So yeah, that would be my main tips.
When it comes to refurbishing a property, what are your top tips?
So in terms of the actual refurbishment, time is almost as important as the resale value. I've talked about this before. Like, you only have so much cash in this business, and you have to churn it and churn it and churn it and churn it. So you need to make sure that you're getting a move on. It's easy to sort of fetishize the profit in something, but actually you also want to look at how long it takes you to get there. And I've talked about it in other episodes, so I won't go into that too much. And one thing I always talk about is having, when a buyer goes round things, you want to make sure that every room is good.
It's one of the first things you said to me.
Yeah, see, there you go. So you want to make sure that, a buyer already sees a property twice normally. Every single room has to be good, and every single room has to have something about it. Even if it's a little tiny hallway, put some amazing tiles in there, put an amazing piece of art on the walls right straight as you come in, especially if it's at the beginning of a property tour. You really need to make sure that, you know, people get something that's a wow factor as soon as they hit the door, so to speak. So that's something I would talk about a lot, and I've talked about it in the past. And buyers, really, when they see poorly done things, they really look for more issues, and then you start to get people reducing the prices they're prepared to pay for things, which is something you want to obviously avoid. Refurbishment hacks. So let's have a think. So we've got we buy doors now off the shelf rather than we used to make them ourselves. Another developer, Christian Cox, that I know, he always used to tell this to me, and to his credit, he was correct. I, as much as that pains me to admit that. In all seriousness, Coxie told me that, and at the time we used to make our own doors because they were 2.4 meters high. And he was like, look, you should just be buying them off the shelf, and he was right. They are much cheaper off the shelf. We now pay, on the cheaper projects we do, we pay £150 a door, and I used to pay like £600 to make them.
Wow.
So big difference, although they were bigger, so it's not quite a fair comparison. So buy things like that off the shelf. People making them in a factory in Eastern Europe or in China are going to be able to do it much cheaper than you can with one of your guys, you know, in a bedroom in St. John's Wood. So I would definitely do that. If you're doing a smaller flat, two beds, two baths or less, just put a combi boiler in. You don't need a Megaflow normally. A lot of people put Megaflow systems in, but they're expensive, and you know, they're not really needed if you've got a small flat. Also, we tend to avoid using wet underfloor heating. I find it's expensive to install. We use electric underfloor heating in smaller rooms where it's more economical, and we tend to avoid using wet underfloor heating. Architects probably screaming at the pod, whatever it is, pod player now, saying no, you should, because there's no radiators and it looks cleaner and fine. But from a development point of view, I don't think it really brings much of a benefit. I think in some circumstances, but generally it's like an extra $5,000 or $10,000 on the install costs. I wouldn't bother, just putting sexy radiators and they look cool. It's worked for us anyway. And also another one with is sash windows. If they're in really bad condition, you're often better just to replace them rather than spend so much time and money trying to get them back to how they should look. And invariably, they never look as good anyway. If it's a listed building, don't just rip them out. You can't often do that if it's original fabric. So just check that. And another thing we do a lot is we get rid of unnecessary hallways. So we're always trying to capitalize on the use of space. So often in the 70s and 80s, things were built very, very poorly in terms of layout. And you'll have random bits of hallway which don't really need to be there, which are taking square bedrooms into being bedrooms with a bit missing out the corner of them. So we will often just get rid of that hallway and make it into the bedroom, make it larger. And obviously that's within reason. You don't want to like have literally like a 600 by 600 hallway when you come in, but if you can improve bedrooms and living spaces, then you're much better to do that. We also use, in terms of fire regulations, which fire regulations can often cause you a bit of a problem as a developer, because especially since Grenfell, they're very strict now. You have to make sure that things are safe, obviously, as you'd want to anyway. And often the layouts you want aren't achievable because of fire regs. So we've had to be quite creative over the years with what we use. So we use fire curtains now to get around fire regulators, not to get around them, but to keep them happy. We also use a misting system, which is kind of like a chemical sprinkler system with less water, and that will enable you to have big open plan spaces where, you know, the means of escape is perhaps compromised in some way. So there are clever ways around having to have walls, fire-rated walls everywhere, and it enables you to create really beautiful open plan spaces. So do have a look into that. Often, building control surveyors will say, no, you can't, there's no other way of doing it, you've got to do it this way, but that's not true. If you push back, there is often a way you can do it legally. So make sure you look into that. Another thing is with kitchen appliances. Kitchens are a really big item of expenditure on any project, and you don't need to spend a fortune on kitchen appliances if you're doing a 200 grand, 300 grand project. You know, you can buy, I would much be more likely to buy a bottom of the range Bosch oven, which people know is a high-end manufacturer, rather than buying a Hoover, like a higher range, higher end range of the range Hoover oven or whatever. I would always go with the more premium brand and a lower model. I think because people inherently think it's better quality when they see it. So that can often save you money, because you can buy a Bosch oven for like 300 quid. Whereas a top of the range Hoover oven might cost you 500 or 600, which you may as well just get a normal Bosch for that sort of money. So that's important. Also, if you want to make a kitchen look great, spend your money on the worktops. You know, you can buy cheaper appliances in a cheaper project and it can still look fantastic. If you get this incredible marble worktop or whatever, concrete worktop, whatever you want to do, Corian, you know, go to town on it. Try to avoid the standard quartz colours. There's like a 3 or 4 quartz worktops that you see in like 80% of all sort of mid-market property developments. Try and avoid them. Try and be a little bit sexier and a bit more, a bit better with your design than just going for the bog standard that you see in every new build home across the country. I would definitely advise that. And also, we've talked about this in our design podcast, use lighting to your absolute advantage. LED lighting's cheap. We use loads of it. It doesn't cost much to buy. It's energy efficient. And you don't need to have like 10 spotlights in every room. Have 4, have 6 maximum, and use feature lighting. It just makes rooms look so much better. When you're showing stuff at night in the winter, for example, everything's got like a mood. It looks fantastic. You really need to have a think about that. And also, I think don't be afraid to use dark colours. Like we will use dark colours in certain rooms. It depends on the room. If it's an incredibly bright room, we might use a darker colour. And equally, if it's a really dark room and it's never going to be bright, we might also use a dark colour because it's always going to be dark. So why not harness that? Make it feel, it does feel luxurious when you have dark walls. So just be a little bit muted in what colours you use. Like, you know, go for a dark greeny blue, a dark bluey grey, or something like that, or a dark greeny grey, or something like that. Don't go for a really dark like a viper green or something. it might put people off. And the final thing about refurbishment hacks: dressing. Like, you've got to dress flats. Honestly, it is. Whenever I see developers not dressing, I just don't understand why. I reckon we spend 1% of our spend on each project on dressing, maybe even less than that. And I reckon we get back 5% more for what we do. And I just don't understand why people don't dress things. Dress again, and then dress again, and you will make money. Even if you make no on paper return on the flat itself, but you make an extra 4% because you've dressed it, it's just a no-brainer. Honestly, you've got to do it. So yeah, now I think that's probably all on refurbishing. There's loads of information coming at you here, so I'm sorry if it's a bit boring, but the idea of this podcast was to make sure that you could write things down and take it all on board.
What's your advice for selling a property successfully?
I think the first thing is don't price too highly. Get at least 3 valuations from the 3 best agents in the area. Try and mix it up. Get a big brand and a local agent who's the best local agent. If they're all telling you it's worth 600k, if they're all telling you it's worth 549, let's say, and you think it's worth 600k, it's almost certainly that you're wrong. Almost certainly. There have been times when agents have told me, it happened with Leamington Road Villas, they told me it was worth 1.6. And one agent said 1.8, and I just had a feeling that it was worth 1.8 just because of the buzz that was around the flat. And anyway, we went on at 1.8, we sold it for 1.8. If I hadn't got that agent in and just had the 2 other agents in, who I won't name, I would have lost 200 grand.
Yeah.
So thanks to the agent that valued it at 1.8, and he actually sold it in the end. So that was good. So yeah, take the agent's advice generally. And if you're really not sure, dip your toe in the water. Don't put the property on the market formally. Do it off market. It's not, there's no trace of it, then on Rightmove. And just bring buyers in. And if you have 10 viewings off the market and no one likes it, there's a good chance it's overpriced. Then you can put it on at the agent's price of 549. So that's, that would be my, my advice. There's also a little point in selling in mid-December to middle of January or end of January even. It's a crap time to sell a property. Same with July and August to an extent. Everyone's on holiday. People aren't really up for looking at houses as much. So I would again, in those times, if we have a project that comes to market in sort of first week of August or first week of Jan, I'll put it on off market, and I'll wait until the market picks up, gauge the interest, maybe put it on a quite a punchy price, see how we get on, and then if it's not working, drop the price and formally launch it. And you know, we generally I've mentioned this before, we'll instruct two agents, joint sole agency, ideally winner takes all, so the winning agent gets anything. That drives them more to sell it. And we try and keep contracts short, 8 weeks. You know, I think if an agent hasn't sold something after 2 months, then unless the market is really tough, there's something probably not right. So you don't want to be locked into a 4 month contract with an agent and then, you know, they stop viewing it after 8 weeks and you're just stuck there for two months. Although in reality, if that did happen, you'd have a pretty good right to say to that agent, listen, you're not doing any viewings. Yeah. You need to stop now. Most agents that are good agents will let you out of a contract. See, top tip here. Most agents will let you out of a contract if they're not pulling their weight and they're not doing the viewings, because it doesn't look good on them if they refuse and you're stuck there. They're better off to cut their losses, move on, and then you'll refer them to other people probably in the future. I think with agents' fees, a lot of people fixate on an agent's fee. I often pay big fees to agents. I'll often pay 2.5% joint sole to agents. And I don't mind doing it because at the end of the day, all I care about is the net price that we get. So if I pay 2.5% but I get 1.5 million for the flat, I'd much rather that than pay 1.5% and get 1.45 million, because the net difference is quite significant.
Yeah.
My maths isn't quick enough today to do that, but I would say it might be 35 grand a difference. A lot of people ring me up for advice and they say, oh, well, yeah, but he's only 1%, so I was going to go there. But I'm like, yeah, but look at his office. It's like he's got 10 instructions and they're all just a rubbish agent. I don't know what, you know, that's why they're 1%.
Yeah.
Foxton's, fair enough, they're 2.5%. I mean, Foxton's have changed a lot in the last year or two since they've had their new CEO. Guy, if you're listening, shout out to you. But they've gone back to the Foxtons of old. Before, they'd got a little bit slower, and now they're very aggressive again. They're doing deals at big prices. So someone like Foxtons or Marsh & Parsons, one of the big guys, they're going to charge more, but they will get the deal done, normally at a higher price. So I say pay more money to the agents. Just make sure that they're going to get you more money net of all the costs. And also, we always add neg bonuses normally. So I'll say to someone, the house is on at 2 million. If you get me anything over 2 million, I'll give you 5% off, for example. So if they get 2 million and 50, you know, then they'll get £2,500 commission direct from me. And I always pay it on exchange of contracts. I don't pay it on completion, because if there's a delayed completion of a month or two, it's great for the neg who sells it to get 2.5 grand before he gets even paid by his own estate agency.
Yeah.
So incentivize estate agents. When it comes to, if you get stuck with stuff and it's not selling, then I also always suggest to people that one big price reduction is better than lots of multiple small price reductions. So let's say you've got a flat on at 500k that you can't sell. The whole point of a price reduction is to bring a different level of buyer in who wouldn't have viewed it at 500k. So rather than sort of bringing it down to, you know, 485 and then 460 and then 450 finally, just bring it down to 450. 10% off, ideally. It's 5, 6, 7, 8% maybe, if you can't stomach a 10% reduction. And just get a whole new demographic of buyer in there. A buyer who's probably registered at 400, 425 will end up buying that flat for 440 probably. And you'll get it sold. Whereas if you drop it to, you know, 480, it's still the same buyers looking at it and discounting it. So that's important. Lots of little price reductions is never a good thing. And also, if things go wrong, I think you know, occasionally we've had flats that we've haven't gone well. We had one during the Brexit vote, which we had to make a call on, and we lost a little bit of money. It wasn't massive. It was about 26,000, I think, we lost. If I hadn't have made that call, we would have probably lost 100 grand because the prices dropped after the Brexit vote. If things aren't going well, then just cut your losses and get out, you know. Drop
cash
the price.
The table.
Exactly. Get your money out. Hopefully you'll break even. Put it down to experience. And whenever you have a deal that doesn't go right, I'm a very positive person generally, but I always like to look at fuck ups and mistakes as ways of you're actually making money in the future for yourself. You just don't realize it. So, like, for example, if I look at the deals that haven't done as well for us, I will never do those deals again now for the next, hopefully, 30 years of my career, even 40 years, because I'm 37. So I hope I'm doing this till I'm in my 70s. So that 10 grand loss at the time may well save you 200 grand over the next 35 years because you don't make the same mistake.
More, yeah.
You know, or even more. So, you know, there's no lesson in life is learnt for free. A developer friend of mine said that to me, and Sam said that, and he's so right. You know, if you make mistakes, you're going to learn hugely from them. You don't learn that much when you just shed loads of money all the time. I mean, it'd be great if you just constantly make loads of money, but you know, you don't learn anything. You don't improve. So I think that's my advice on that front.
Have you got any other advice once your project's been sold?
I think, yeah, start looking for the next project. You know, that's that. In all seriousness, I mean, as soon as I get an offer on something, I'm looking to buy again. Because in an ideal world, you want to, the churn of cash is so important, as I say. So as soon as that offer comes in, start looking. Hopefully you're in a position where you could buy without selling that, but let's assume you're a new developer and you can't because you don't have the cash available. Then, you know, you've got to just hope that you can keep the two deals together. And it's not easy to do, to be fair. I've done it a number of times when I was a younger developer and I was reliant on that selling. But there have been a couple of occasions where literally we've exchanged on the sale and then the next day or the next week exchanged on the purchase, and you're literally bouncing your cash from one to the next. So, you know, it's your return on equity for your investors, if you've got investors, or for yourself is much better. Yeah. So get looking, and the more you're looking for stuff, the more that you're aware of what the market's doing as well. And because a lot of the time, when you've got, like, the moment as a company, we've got a number of projects, and we are looking to buy if something amazing comes up, but it has to be compelling because we have such a big land bank, if you want, of deals that we're doing. So, well, I'm not in the market at the moment, really. Like, I'm not speaking to agents every day because I need to buy. So you don't want to be in that position for too long. You want to spend at least 6 months of the year while you're actively looking for things, because otherwise you lose track of what's happening. So you want to get straight back into it and do that. And I think the other thing, the key thing as a developer, is when you sell something, make sure you save your corporation tax in a separate account somewhere, because let me tell you, the amount of developers that do not save their corporation tax and then wait till their end of their tax year thinking they're going to get another deal done by then and pay the 100 grand that they owe HMRC and they can't, it's a big problem. So save your tax in a separate account, and I've always been told that by my accountant. So that would be my other advice. Find a new project, save the tax from hopefully all the profit you've made on that one. And I think that brings us to a close on this. It's been thanks for everyone that's listened for the last 8 months. It's been an experience for me. It's doing a podcast is way more involved than I realized, and I took it on probably I was a little bit naive about what was involved, and but it's been a lot of fun, and I've learned a huge amount from it. So thank you to each and every one of you that have listened to us, and who knows, maybe we'll be back again in the future.